Edward Lengel is our guest here on The Paula Gordon Show. I'm Paula. Bill Russell and Edward Lengel were just talking about the Meuse-Argonne, part of the World War I experience as seen from the Americans' perspective. And the full look at that campaign is within the larger context of World War I. You call it To Conquer Hell. You talk about intelligence, Bill. How in the world can you be intelligent about conquering hell?
Difficult question. It's a question of there's not one answer to how to handle this situation. I don't think that anybody had the one key that would open up the Meuse-Argonne and allow the American army to win a victory with few or no casualties whatsoever. But
there's it didn't have to be a slaughterhouse.
Didn't have to be a slaughterhouse. And we were talking about how Pershing kicked himself upstairs and let Hunter Liggett take command of First Army fighting this battle. And Hunter Liggett's idea was gathering intelligence about what's going on at the front, but he was also much more focused on morale. How are the doughboys handling this situation up here? Now, before he came in, the attitude had been, we don't really want to hear about that on the part of
explicitly.
The generals. Explicitly, yeah. There was very little interest in how this kind of fighting, this kind of suffering was affecting the doughboys. Hunter Liggett discovered what had been apparent for a long time, that their morale was collapsing. It was collapsing, and they're put sitting out there under the rain, under the gas, the German bombardments, machine guns, making almost no gain. They would
tremendous smell from all the dead and
sure.
wounded bodies
no
all
food,
around
no
them.
Food and no sleep.
And large
right.
rats.
Right. Yeah, that's right.
The size of cats.
But also the experience, at least if you feel you're moving forward, then at least you can justify it in some ways. But so many times in this battle, they're told to capture woods or capture a town, and they attack again and again, and they finally take it, and then they find the guys on their flanks haven't advanced far enough, so they have to pull back and give it up. And then the next day, they have to take it again.
You also tell a story, I think it's about George Marshall, speaking of intelligence, taking some of the staff officers or officers hanging around headquarters complaining because they didn't get to be heroes and sending them up to the front lines with carrier pigeons.
Right.
Which was, I thought, just a stunt because, you know, the communications was spotty at best. But that seemed, I mean, that's the kind of imagination and initiative you would like from somebody in that position.
Right.
And George Marshall, once again, who is unknown to most people in America. This is the Marshall Plan, right. Marshall, from the next war. But George Marshall comes out really pretty well in the course of you telling the story.
Right. Marshall was an incredible man, really. He was the guy who handled moving this entire army up to the front. He was solely in charge of it. And two, he was a very creative thinker. This is an example of kind of the critical problem in fighting in World War I is really the lack of communications, is that the generals very often, they don't know where their troops are simply because there's no way to get information quickly from the front. So Marshall develops this plan of, you know, using large numbers of carrier pigeons. He sent these young intelligence officers who wanted to see some of the battle. He sent them out during the final advance and, you know, gave them the experience and actually helped the army at the same time.
Well, and this is before carrier pigeons were extinct, and they actually carried messages.
This is passenger pigeons. You're
I am. But the idea
you can ride to battle on a passenger pigeon. Carrier pigeons just carry messages. Right?
And it worked. And you talk about one poor, sorry little carrier pigeon who comes back with one wing this way, but had he this little pigeon not made it, then they've got runners. And of course, it's hard to not remember that Hitler was a runner in World War One. It's also, now we're talking about real people here, Harry Truman is another little remembered, but a very good officer with a very rich set of language skills. How'd I do?
He kind of had to be because his battery was made up of Irishmen from Kansas City who were notorious for full-scale fist fights, you know, and free-for-alls. So he kind of had to be feisty to keep his unit running.
The fact that you have done this from the bottom up and have made real people out of this has brought to life that about which America doesn't want to talk.
Right. It's one of the things I was going to say is that a lot of known characters, well-known characters, will pop up in this book. James M. Cain, the novelist, and Damon Runyon, the journalist. Obviously, Marshall was there. MacArthur was there. MacArthur doesn't come off too well.
He doesn't change any.
Truman was there. But I think one of the things that should bring to mind is that really so many of these people, you know, they later become, you know, leaders in American society. And it helps to remind us that really this war did transform an entire generation. I keep finding, as I read more after I wrote the book, more and more people I didn't realize had been there, had experienced this. And I just read recently, I found out that Busby Berkeley had been there.
That's where he got his choreography.
Yeah, the choreographer. and he developed his style of musicals from his experience in the war. So it's interesting.
There's one other of the usual suspects we haven't talked about, the media, the role of the media. And I think of it particularly with respect to the one thing that I think people might remember, or at least the name, and that's the Lost Battalion. Mm-hmm. Which is, you know, to me, the most obvious place, at least by your presentation, of how the media finally intersected,
right,
with this war, and it basically ends badly.
Yeah.
In spite of all the good, you know, all the hoopla around it, can you do a short course on that?
The Lost Battalion is one of the few areas where Americans are actually interested in what the doughboys went through in World War One because it makes a good story.
No, entertainment.
It has, you know, it's good, has good entertainment value, really. You have, you know, this battalion of troops. It wasn't really a battalion. It was a mixture of two battalions from who were a mixture of New York City's toughest
some, you know, of
guys,
mobsters.
Yeah, mobsters. There's some mobsters in there, you know, from the toughest neighborhoods in New York City, mixed in with completely green farm boys. This was the way the Army did things in World War One.
And they sort of didn't, they hadn't met before. It's not like they'd gone through training together.
Right, exactly. And they're caught behind the German lines in the Argonne Forest. I visited there last year. It's incredible. It's all as it was at the time. And they're caught behind the lines, and the Germans are attacking them constantly. And this goes on for 5 days. That they're trapped there,
with no food, with no water, with no anything,
right?
Anything,
no care for the wounded, and it's a terrible experience. So, you know, I could go on at length telling the story, but I won't. But anyway, they bond together, they survive. The Germans make one final attack. Essentially, you have like Bastogne in World War II. You know, the Germans offer to treat them honorably as prisoners and ask them to surrender. And Whittlesey, Charles Whittlesey, the American commander, pretty much just ignores them or says nuts. They treat it as a joke. And they're able to fight the Germans off, and they survive. But there's a tragic subplot to this which people are not interested in as part of the story, which was how this battle haunted not only the soldiers, the individual doughboys who were there, but Whittlesey, the commander. Like many officers who lose large numbers of their men in combat, he felt responsible for every single one. He felt guilty for every single one. And at the end of the war, the media has made such a big deal about the Lost Battalion. Damon Runyon was one of the guys there, you know, using his language to
his hyperbolic skills.
Yeah, right. His hyperbolic skills to blow it up. And at the end of the war, Whittlesey has won the Medal of Honor. He's a great hero, and he's wined and dined, and the politicians love to have him there. But he can't stand it. He is kind of zones out of what they're trying to do with him and how they're trying to use him, you know, as a symbol. And inside, he's tearing himself apart because of his guilt at what happened, and then eventually he kills himself. He gets on a steamer ship to Cuba and leaps overboard just because he can't bear the thought of these guys who had fought and died there.
You also, there's a part of this that blessedly, when you wrap this up, history is also elusive, and it's not clear what the circumstances were. I mean, we have a stereotype of the Lost Battalion, you know, X, Y, and Z, and it turns out none of that is readily verifiable, up to and including it is conceivable that they actually outnumbered the Germans who were nominally surrounding them.
That's true.
And there's a certain, to me, humbling quality to that in terms of what we think we know, as opposed to the reality that's out there.
There are a lot of myths about the Lost Battalion. There are myths about Alvin C. York as well. And it's difficult to get to the truth. And, York, for example, probably was not solely responsible for capturing all 132 Germans. We forget his unit was there too, and they also helped to capture these Germans. The Lost Battalion, this is one myth, but there are many others as well.
Lest we forget. This is a bad idea to forget. To conquer hell, the Meuse-Argonne in 1918 is the specific of what we're talking about with Edward Lengel. We will be back in just a moment. Bill Russell, I, Paula Gordon, for a few more minutes. Do join us.